to the greatest podcast on Earth! Step right up and experience the magnificence that is the Two Ring Circus Podcast! You'll gasp! You'll laugh! And you'll be amazed at what comes next! Don't worry about the smell. It's just the stars of our show, Tom Italiano.
G'day.
And Matt Gretchor.
Bird.
Welcome.
Welcome, Bird.
We're
in the
sky.
Are you talking to me? We're in the sky now. We're on level two, and the bird flew up here to say hello.
Yeah, we're on level two at the Elephant and Wheelbarrow in sunny Melbourne, in the city.
Sorry.
And there's a sparrow flying around. There's no windows open here.
No, we're coming through the door and up the crevasse that is the stairwell.
Crevasse?
Is that what it is?
It's just a stairwell.
Ah, yes. Mm. Well.
It's like a laddered stocking. Stairway to heaven.
Not always.
Ever heard that phrase?
I've heard it.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty funny. Yeah.
But, you know, I don't believe it.
No. In fact, yeah. A leaded stocking is usually the very opposite.
It's stairway to hell.
Well, in its own way.
How's your week?
It's a bit personal. Oh, I see. No, good.
How's your last 7 days?
Good, man.
That's good.
Yeah. Busy. Mm. Busy. When were we last together? Had I been with the students at SAE the last time you and I spoke, or was I going?
The last time we spoke,
I've
yes,
just done it.
But not on the podcast.
Yeah, that's right. So in between times, I've just done a lot of gigs, including the Begonia Festival in Ballarat.
Yep.
Which was super good fun.
Was Steve there?
Stevie K's?
No, Steve Begonia. He's our friend. He might be less my friend now. He was so my friend the other day. He kept surprised me at my gig. He said he couldn't come, and then he showed up.
No, yeah. Little fella.
I was. There were two people who showed that I had no idea. Like who said they weren't able to come because they had other stuff, and they showed up. But I was like pretty chuffed.
Awesome.
Yeah. There were other people who showed up too, and I was happy to see them as well. But these were surprises. So.
So, note to yourselves, if ever you want to make Dom smile and potentially mention you after the fact, just surprise him.
Also, I mentioned Robbie as well. Because I didn't mention him, and he was the other person.
Robbie.
Who... Pardon?
Robbie.
What's his surname? Robbie R2. Thompson. It is Thompson. Yeah.
I saw him on Monday with Rosie down at the Begonia Festival.
Because they were at the Steve Festival. Yes, in Ballarat.
Yes. Oh, God.
I know. It's hard work.
Yeah, stop, dude.
Sorry.
Tell me about your launch before we launch.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was lovely. I had that idea that I didn't want to do... If I was going to do a sitting launch, I didn't want there to be televisions or a bar in the same room as the music. Because pretty much anywhere I play... where there's a telephone or a bar, the music is subsidiary to any other... Mm. Not just the music, but like the ability for anyone who wants to pay attention to the music. A, they're distracted by televisions, which is just natural reptilian behaviour when there's shit going on. You just
Absolutely.
Kind of, you know, you're always on the...
Doesn't matter what it is.
And also the same with the bar, you know, there's always someone... Well, not always, but in most situations where you play music, there is someone working behind the bar who's not paying attention to what's happening in the room and throws a bottle in the bin at the most inopportune time, or occasionally incredibly opportune, but you can't sync that up. So I wanted it to be in a place like that. The last couple of original gigs I'd done had been horrendous experiences because of those issues.
Where did you do this launch?
I did it at the Wesleyan in Northcote. What was really interesting is that, yeah, the people were chatting. I mean, I made sure it was all ages too, so people who had kids could come, and that was really nice because there's about 35 kids kind of playing, rolling around on the floor and stuff. But there wasn't a lot of people on their phones. If they were, they were filming something specific. They weren't just kind of checking their Facebook. It was like if you take... the distractions away, then people are less distracted by stuff that's not directly in front of them. So if their phone's in their pocket, they don't think to get it out.
Do you think that's what it is, or do you think they were just being respectful of your
performance? I think once you distract, the more distractions you have, the more you're likely to think of other distractions in your life. So like, oh, I might check that, I might do this.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
I say that because that's how I am. So if I go to a concert and there's big screens everywhere, I notice that people have their phones out more. If I go to a gig and there's just a band on stage, there's less phones out. It's like there tends to be, oh, this is an acceptable thing to have and do because there's screens everywhere. Okay. And even in pubs where there's like five different sporting events on TVs around, then people have got their phones out all the time. And in a pub where there's no TVs anywhere, people are actually just having a chat. And in that space together, less likely to be on their phone.
Okay.
It's certainly less likely to be going with it. That was me pretending to film Matt's face with a pretend camera.
it was quite the Marcel Marceau moment.
So was that.
Good.
So it was great. It was wonderful. It was it actually went about as close to plan as almost anything I've ever done. Because nothing ever goes to plan. Like, it's always like, everything always takes twice as long for me, and...
Everything takes twice as long for anyone. At least twice as long. You pretty well anything... Don't you find anything... Any task that you think is going to take a certain amount of time almost always takes double. I find it with music projects, with...
I'm pretty... Yes, I mean, I really do, but that is true. I find that when I'm relying on other people to be a part of something, then I feel like that's what is the...
You're right. Other people are pricks.
Well,
and they can't get anything done except in double the time.
Well, it's just that expectation thing, isn't it? Like, they have an expectation of how something's going to go, and if you don't give them the guidelines of how this is going to go, then they bring their own expectation, which is their own preconceived time frame of stuff.
Huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So for like, I organise this.
Do you overthink things?
No.
Sometimes stuff just doesn't know. All right. Thank you. Good night.
Well, what I mean by that is, I think I give things the requisite thought that I feel they need to have. And often that is...
Probably might say that.
No, what I mean by that is, like, for example, let's say we do, out of every 10 weddings, like, we might do, we clearly the one factor that's the same, like, we go and play them, but we might play them with 10 different people. And what I generally find is the people who tell the client, this is what I do, the wedding goes really smoothly and everything's fine. And the people who say, what do you want, to the client, it's like open slather. And then there's 50 emails back and forth and we're learning 10 songs for the gig and it's an absolute nightmare because they don't do the planning. They let other people. So what I'm kind of getting at, like, there was a few things in the lead up that didn't go right, but because I was on top of them, they didn't affect the day.
Yeah.
Now, maybe for people who don't organise anything at all, they just rock up and do stuff, it's not a problem. But they might also not have the same reservations about whether there's TVs in a room and stuff like that as I do. So, maybe I do think too much.
Mm.
But you think how much you think. That's how much you have to think.
Sure. Mm.
Do talk too much, though. What do you want to talk about?
No, I'm good. I don't want to talk about anything.
Don't talk about anything. No. Is that Dr. Seuss? Did he have a stork book?
No, yeah, the Sneetches book.
Sneetches.
You remember the Sneetches?
What's your favourite Dr. Seuss book?
Probably that one.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine's On Beyond Zebra.
Pardon?
It has to be Zebra, because the thing is, right, so the book's about the alphabet, and it's the idea that most people stop at Z, but not me, because then there's all these other made-up letters that it's that idea of if you just think in the parameters that you're given, well, that's all you're going to have. But because it's American and it's On Beyond Zebra, it has to stop, because the Z me rhymes with Z, so it has to be Z. It can't be Z because some stop at Z, yes. But not me.
Yeah.
Doesn't work. So
it's very hard. Your favourite?
Well, no, it's just a message of like, you know, kind of having the freedom to think.
What's what another letter?
Oomph is for oomph, 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 oomph. Okay, stuff like that. Good. Yeah. But it's great to read that story to like a 6-year-old who's just learnt the alphabet. It's not Z, it's Z. It's great. Okay, this is exactly for you, for your age right now.
When I was a not kid, you. I used to grapple with... No, thanks, dude. I used to grapple with the idea, that very idea, that there was only 26 letters and actually that is the finite amount because you can't make any more because every other letter sound you make with. Is used up... Is comprised of the other letters, which of course they all are. Like Z is.
Do you think too much?
Z E D. No. But that was a genuine thought process I had with a kid. It's like I want to invent some more letters, but I can't. Yeah. Like oomph, I couldn't have invented oomph because that's 00MPH.
Maybe. But maybe not.
But
because all letters now with the pronunciation of the letters combine. Other letters to pronounce them.
Exactly,
so that's okay, you can invent whatever you want. So that's fine.
I couldn't make my child brain access that information.
So like this, for example, is a 1 and a 2, and put together is a 12, but you could put it on the side and call it a flubberbub, or a clank. Right, and then why would we need that letter? Because of this word.
Yeah.
Or this thing that exists, or this idea that exists. So yeah, I think you can do that.
Okay.
Go for it, Matt.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah. Make the mat for bet.
I'm going to go back and tell my 6 or 7 year old self that.
If you could go back to your 6 or 7 year old self, what would you tell them, actually?
6 or 7?
Yeah. I think I would just say, read this book when you're 15. Oh, if I'd had this book 5 years ago. No, 8 years ago.
Yeah?
Oh, God.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You're really getting that much out of it?
Well, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You okay?
Yeah. Particularly chapter 2, which we might talk about today.
Let's talk about it now.
How's that for a standing up on two wheels thing?
It's good.
Yeah, good like that.
Yeah. I recall being quite upset that Segway wasn't spelt the same way as Segway.
Oh, I'm often upset when things are not spelt the same way as I think they should.
Hmm.
Like most people's names under 20 years old these days.
A Facebook friend of mine recently, you know, just in the context of just trying to generate some sort of conversation in that forum, said, right, today's subject is stupid spelling of names. What's going on? I'm going to start with, and I think they had Jackson, which was
with an
J A X S O N. So an X and an S.
So Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, inevitably, though, of course, because I'm a fairly avid Facebook user, so I'm aware of the irony inherent in this, but. There's a lot of Facebook users that have kids with terrible names, and a lot of them chimed in. It's like, hang on a second. My kid's name's, you know, Blake, B-L-A-Y-K-E-X-P, you know.
I think of anyone, I've said this before, and I usually get held down, and quite rightly so, but I still feel quite strongly about it because I don't have my own kids. I think the... Of all the single decisions you can make for a child, I think the name is the most important.
Are you named after someone?
No, my mum knew I was a Dominic the moment she looked at me.
Really?
Yeah. And there's not much more she can do to explain that other than I was going to be Michaela, I think. Something
it's
like
a miracle
that.
A girl with a winkle.
I don't know, I just think I know we make that I make that joke about, you know, if you're gonna have a kid, give it a chantable name, so if they get in a fight, because Jackson's never gonna get any backup from the crowd.
What?
Yeah, I mean Jackson's never like Rocky's, but way better. like Matt. Much better than Jackson.
I don't agree.
Well, I reckon.
No, Jackson rolls off the tongue a lot better. You can't have a single syllable chant.
No, but the thing is, if you spell it Jackson, J-A-K-S-O-N, yes, then people would understand, but like, how do we say his name?
Is it Jason? What if it's pronounced Jason?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant.
The best one I heard was, which is not even a misspelling, it was a total misreading of the name, was someone I know who's a midwife came in and looked at, you know, the name on the board and went, "Ah, Yvonne, that's such a lovely name. That's my my mother-in-law's name." And they've gone, "Yvonne? No, it's Wyvernie."
No.
Yeah, they looked in the book and went, "Oh, that's cool, Wyvernie."
No.
Yeah. Which actually, in their defense, fair enough.
Oh, brilliant.
In their defense, kind of like, yeah, I guess you can see
why. It's urban myth. I feel like it's the sort of thing you should be able to look up. There was an old talent show on TV called Potluck.
That was happened.
Bernard King was one of the judges on. And the story goes that a guy came in. I can't think of what the musical is that the song's from. You will know. You know, you say potato and I say potato. You say tomato and I potato. Yeah. Potato. Yep. But he just came in and sang, yeah, what's it from? Kiss Me Kate?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know actually.
And he just came in and sang, you sing potato and I sing potato. You say tomato and I say tomato. Potato, potato, tomato. Sang the whole song. And Bernie King said, have you ever heard the song? He said, no, I just got the sheet music.
Oh, I wish...
I want it to be true.
I wish that they had heard the song and just decided to, like, that's something I would do. That's cute. Funny.
12 rules for life.
Can you tell how on edge I am about this audio potentially not working in this forum?
No.
Oh, okay, good. Good, I'm a great actor. Well, you say actor, I say actor.
Because you're afraid that it's going to stop.
Oh, because the last few times we've used this setup in this fashion.
Oh, yeah.
We have it in the car, but it's failed.
We haven't got the desk.
It's failed by now.
Okay. Well, yeah. don't jinx it, because I think that's how technology works. It understands. It's sentient in some way.
It jinxes.
Mm. Jinxes.
Maybe I made the right sacrifice today.
The book we're discussing for this podcast today, and last podcast, and indeed the next 10, is a book called 12 Rules for Life by a clinical psychologist named Jordan B. Peterson. An Antidote to Chaos is its subtitle, and we are on to rule number 2 of 12.
And it's heavy as heck.
It's not as heavy as the next one.
Well, no, but, you know, it's a good setup.
Man.
Isn't it?
The title of chapter 2 is Treat Yourself Like Someone You Are Responsible for Helping.
Mm-hmm. So the kind of premise is it suggests that there's something about people that they would tend to take on responsibility for other people and even their pets, like administering medication in the proper way, but when it comes to looking after themselves, 60-odd% of people don't even fill a prescription that they've been given by a doctor, and then so a third of people don't even get the prescription, and the other third don't take it properly.
Do you do that?
I have.
Really?
I have when I have been completely dissatisfied with the general practitioner's experience.
Okay.
And that has, like, a couple of times when I've gone in, I'm like, you're not looking at me. Like, you know, when you go in. And also a few times when I've been in, it's like, you look so unhealthy, I need to go and see someone else. Like, I'm not suggesting that you don't know what you're talking about, but it just feels like,
yeah,
this is not.
Yeah, well, you'd think a GP would practice what they preach.
I mean, I know they generally practice what they preach, but they don't seem to specifically practice it. And that. So a couple of times I'm like, no, I don't. You've got tonsillitis, and they give you a script, and you go, yeah, this isn't this is what, this doesn't work on me, this thing I tried this 2 years ago. Mm. And they're like, oh, well, that's what I'm going to give you. And you go, well, that...
Has that happened?
Yeah, that's happened, yeah.
I assume that person's not your doctor now.
No, well, I've had... Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I haven't had a consistent doctor for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. And then what it really... So it sort of starts off talking about, you know, people... from his experience as a clinical psychologist, it's like people don't want to look after themselves. They don't want to treat themselves as something that's worthy of being cared for. And that they're
much more likely to look after other people or animals.
Yeah.
So other sentient beings that they perceive as being more vulnerable, they're much more likely to look after those than they are themselves.
Yeah. And certainly they perceive other things as worthy of their care and attention. But that they're not worthy of their own, which the chapter then really delves into. So why do people feel like this, and what throughout our history could possibly explain it? And then he goes into the Bible stories of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 of how we were created, the idea or the story of how God created the earth, and then the story of Adam and Eve, and what how that kind of, those stories explain how we are human, have come to be human the way we are. That's quite a stretch, but it's a pretty compelling
it works.
Dissertation, isn't it?
So it talks about the creation of Adam and Eve, and the ways in which their behaviour in the Garden of Eden, the eating of the apple from the forbidden tree, how that explains our sense of lack of sense of self.
Yeah, our self-consciousness, self-shame.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So, do you want to talk about shame?
Sure.
In amongst it, I've got arrows that go from where I spoke here to where I wrote here. Okay, so the idea that because of the shame we feel as regards our own self-consciousness, as regards the way we perceive our being projected to the world, that makes us incredibly self-conscious and really highly perceptive to our own faults, and therefore a stumbling block to being able to achieve what he calls a higher status, a higher social status.
Well, he uses he uses nakedness as a metaphor, like nakedness in the Garden of Eden, like, you know, man and woman are naked, but they're not aware that naked is something to be conscious of until they eat the forbidden fruit. Mm. And then they see their nakedness as something to be concerned about, and then he sees nakedness as an awareness of our vulnerability and our openness to being attacked and being vulnerable. Mm. Not just being attacked, but the kind of the idea...
Physically and...
Yeah, the idea that the serpent, that the devil is the ultimate, it's like an internal threat.
Yeah,
it's like the nakedness is a self, like self-consciousness and self-awareness is itself the thing that you kind of go, oh, well, that's what's going to make me either do good or do bad.
Yeah, paradoxically I found though as well that he doesn't agree at all that shame is in and of itself a negative emotion.
Hmm.
And in fact, almost the opposite, that shamelessness is a synonym for psychopathy.
Yeah.
So we need to be aware of it, but in a way that we can then use that to our advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah, does that sound right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, and that's wrapped up in what he talks about in the start of the chapter about walking the line between chaos and order.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
That I found the most compelling part of the whole chapter.
Yeah.
Sorry, I jumped in.
I think a lot of the analysis of the text and then the sort of saying how this is a story that explains. I really like how he used the biblical stuff as this is a story that explains what humans do and how humans behave, not what happened. It's like it's a story about human nature.
It's the other way.
Also in particular about the bit where he's like, so even God in all his greatness creates Eden, the perfect place on earth, and still can't create it without a demon. And so there's still a snake of temptation that talks to humans to say, you know, no matter what you do, there's always going to be a metaphorical
and that's
snake in you.
And that's because he posits that the only way to kind of to move forward as a being with a capital B in your life is to understand that there is order and chaos to the world. And I loved, I haven't got the exact quote, and I didn't write it down because I was driving when I listened to it, but the idea that in order to I'm paraphrasing dramatically here, but in order to become a fully rounded member of society that feels that one, I, you, have self-worth, you need to be able to have a foot in both camps. That you are, you've got a one part of yourself that's in the world that you understand, that everything you've come to so far, this is all the stuff that I get, but you need to have a foot firmly in the other camp as well of chaos, in which that's where you're. The only way you can learn to understand and make sense of that chaos is to be firmly grounded in the other side as well.
Yeah.
Which is just...
Which I kind of looked... when I heard that and then I went and read it, I very much saw that as to explain what walking is. So walking is a physical action through time and space. And when you've got one foot that's... If you're standing still... Right, you're in order, right? And once you take one step, that movement, that's the chaos.
Yep.
Until the foot goes down, then you're in order, and then the next thing you're in chaos. So you're always, is that thing
that's
of having...
Cool. Is this your metaphor?
Yeah.
I love it.
So even though you kind of always wanting to have one foot in one or one in the other, you actually can't do that moving through time. You are always... on the way through chaos and order. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I like what he says in the
book. To use your metaphor, though, if order could be defined as the ground beneath you, then when you've got one foot on the ground, you've got one foot in the world of order,
but you're always,
and the other one...
But because you're always moving, there's always this thing of kind of goes, so this is familiar, we're familiar, but we're always moving through. Even if you stay totally still, you can't... That's not something... You're not actually staying totally still because everything's changing around you. So you're always in order and chaos at the same time.
Okay.
Which is that thing of having one... Figuratively, metaphorically, we are always having one foot in either side.
Hmm.
But because of time and space, you are actually always moving through both at the same time.
All right.
It's taking that thing, just that... step further, I find really a powerful explanation for why when I hear people say, oh, you know, I just want to be in the moment, just like you can't be in the moment, really. You kind of always,
you know what people,
you know, I know, but it seems like when people say they say they want to be in something and what they want is the moment to be something that is tangible and stoppable. And that's just not how things are, right? But I get the metaphor, I get what people are trying to achieve, but also it's this almost kind of like, actually, what you want is movement. and you want it to be a manageable amount of chaos and order.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know,
it's
too much.
The manageable amount.
Yeah, too much chaos is falling over on your ass, like, and too much order is standing still and not going anywhere. Mm. And so being in the moment is kind of more like flow. In that, if you know what I mean. Anyway, it's a great thing about this chapter is like, wow, it's got a lot of stages to it, and I particularly like the bit that comes after this, where it's like, you know, I love the language he uses about, you know, being alive is a terrible burden. It is absolutely, if you think about what it's like to bear the brunt of life, it is amazing that anything gets done by anyone ever, because somebody is always going through something painful, traumatic, physically debilitating.
Well, again, and I'm sure we must have spoken about it in the first episode, that's the first of the four main Buddhist precepts.
Yes.
Is that any one of us, while we're in the process of being a human, of being alive, we're in suffrage.
Yeah.
And the way forward is to try to make sense of what that means.
Yeah. He doesn't say it here, but
when Jim Carrey in that documentary says that death is a blessed relief.
Well, it's like, you know, I read a lyric about a year ago, and it was, you know, it was not like it's an original thing, but I wrote this thing. There's no getting out of this alive. So it's like while we're, it's like that realization that there's no happy ending, really, because in a sense of, it's not a fairy tale. Like we're all gonna die. That's kind of pretty full on. Like, and so, you know, it makes you kind of think. So how should I live? Like, so while I'm here, just going, well, I'm gonna die, I might as well fucking not put any effort in. Just it seems like a shitty conclusion to come to. But if you actually don't start assessing what it is you have, your ideas about stuff, it's actually just generally how you're probably going to live.
We've all of us come into contact with people who I think genuinely feel like that.
Absolutely.
Think like that, but behave
been,
like
been
that.
Been that guy. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you're the one telling the story, but I might be thinking of it from a different perspective.
The thing is, and this is the interesting thing, which is why when we've spoken before about you know, being in dark places and having experience with depression, not suffering, but like having, you know, like the language you use, and most people will, you know, if they can get to a point where they can talk about it, they'll say, no, when I'm with other people, I'm pretty good. I've got purpose, I've got interaction, it feels like that's what humans are meant to do, to be around other people. It's when, or I'm here for a purpose in this moment, so whether we're at work or whatever, and the conversations that people have around people who have committed suicide, you know, or gone through terrible things, like, oh, no one would have ever known, he seemed like a happy-go-lucky guy. Because out of the moment of interaction with other people is where you experience those thoughts of you know, darkness and self-destruction and thinking that you are not worthy of someone to look after. Because generally what happens is when you get around other people, you focus on being with them, not being alone with your own, you know, thoughts about yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, the idea that the people you're around have you around because they see value in you,
or don't be a burden on other people, so when you are around them, like, don't be a pain in the ass, like, actually, you know, contribute, you know, to the scenario.
I had the conversation with some people at my gig last Sunday who I haven't seen for a long time, and they were, I'm so sorry we haven't been here. It's like, actually, we haven't seen you since last year. I said, it's okay. I said, well, if I ever was one of those friends, I learned not to be the guy who, when you haven't seen someone for a long time, spends the first 15 minutes of the conversation just berating the other person for not having been around for so long. It's like, that's not how this shit works. What are you doing? Yeah. Just be happy they're here now.
Yeah.
No, I can't believe you've neglected this yeah. for so long. You fuck. By the way, use of the word fuck. Alia took us to task. Well, mainly me. Yeah, not allowed to say the F word anymore.
On this?
Yeah.
Why?
I said, you're 9 years old, you shouldn't be listening to it. Well, it comes on in the car and then mum doesn't stop it in time.
Don't get me started on that. Okay. Let's just get back on topic.
Oh, sorry, dude.
Yeah. Actually, no, get me started on it.
No.
In this sense, what have we got here? I made a point because I thought this was a really important point. Oh, look, I can't find it though. Here we go. Great. It is far better to render beings in your care competent than to protect them. Right? And this is exactly that thing about, like, oh, kids shouldn't hear bad language and stuff like that, which I don't agree with. Question for parents. Do you want to make your children safe or strong? And that's the idea of protecting people. And it's like that idea of playing rough and tumble with kids. And like, well, you got to play rough and tumble and then fall over and hurt themselves. They got to learn. The only way you get to learn how to stand up is to fall over.
Yes.
You can't.
I nearly sent you a link to a story that happened just not long after you and I spoke last time, about a kid who broke his leg on a trampoline.
Oh, yeah?
I didn't know if you'd see the funny side of it, so I didn't send it.
No, you should have. I would have seen the funny side of it. Yeah. But that's the thing, like, you know.
So Peterson uses the Genesis story to explain that scenario as well, that God told Adam and Eve not to eat. You can eat the fruit from that tree. Don't eat the fruit from that tree. And the idea of how that extrapolates into parenting. It's like, how obedient or disobedient do you want your kids to be? You want them to be obedient enough that they don't get themselves maimed or killed, but disobedient enough that they do something great with their lives. Break some rules, make some mistakes, find some shit out.
Yep.
It's pretty cool.
As well, like, you know, as a metaphor, as the explanation of, so why do humans have such incredible eyesight as opposed to any other animal, right? And that might be because the metaphor of snakes, again, like, you know, the thing that was probably going to kill you if you lived in a tree, like, because nothing on the ground would kill you, like, but snakes would probably kill your babies, right? And also eating the wrong food. So the idea of not eating the food from the tree of knowledge, is it?
The idea was that if you ate that apple, that you would essentially become a god yourself. You would have all knowledge.
Well, here's the ultimate learning experience. Eat that, you die. Eat that, you live. Right? So that's kind of, you know, I mean, that's not in the book, but it's the idea of, like, so be careful of what you eat. Be careful. And so the idea of developing acute eyesight to save you from the dangers of something that can kill you, and the other point is to save you from picking the wrong thing and eating it, which can also kill you, right? And the other thing is to also enable you to pick the right things to eat that will keep you alive. It's the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So even that as a metaphor, good stuff keeps you alive if you eat it, and bad stuff kills you if you eat it. That's pretty much the knowledge of good and evil. And that's also a metaphor for what's inside you. Like, pick the good ideas that will help you live and try not to embrace the bad ideas that make you not want to live. Nanus flies. I find it interesting that to look at when that parenting stuff, to see how my dad is, well, certainly how my dad tells the story of what he was like as dad when I was a baby and what, you know, my mum was like. Because I had a hair lip, cleft palate, so I was in and out of hospital, you know, a lot, having surgery. And my dad's, you know, my dad's of the generation of, like, you know, boys do this, girls do this kind of thing. But, you know, he's just a boy. And the idea that boys roll around in the dirt and hurt themselves, and that's how they get coordinated, and that's how they learn to explore. And I think there's other stories, that's why so many of our stories are about men going off to explore the world and there are less stories about women doing that, because in our history that's actually what men and women have done.
Absolutely.
And not just explorers, but I mean just like, oh well, you know, if there's no food nearby, boys are going to go get it. So boys have got to learn how to fall over and, you know, get hurt and keep going. This is why man flu exists. Like, man flu needs to put men in bed for 4 days because we're too stupid to rest. You know, like this idea, you know, we're like...
Man flu's a cold. That's the joke.
But that's a physiological reason that when you get sick, you go, it's like it's massive overreaction, because men have got this idea that we can just work through it. Now, we have this proclivity to do that, where what we actually need to do is stop and rest and get better. Women are very good at going, I don't feel great, I'm just gonna chill a bit. But boys would just go to work and then they'll get pneumonia and die. They won't go back in the cave and have a rest and sit down. They'll go and try and get the next meal for tomorrow. And what ends up happening if you do that is that no one gets any food and the whole village dies.
Yeah.
So the modern version of like men get man flu, right? Men have always had that reaction when they're sick, and the ones that didn't died. Their genes died out. The ones that kind of went, their bodies went shook, all right, they lived. Not the point. But the point, like, talking about my dad, like, you know, apparently when I was a baby, like, he would hang me on the clothesline, like, by my hands. It's like, look, that's what hands do. And little babies can hold on to clotheslines for, like, 2 minutes before they start going, wah, this is a bit scary now, because it's something in our brain goes, yeah, do that, and that's fine. The story of he needed to run speaker cables like from one room to another, right? And the only way he could think of doing it is lift up a floorboard at one room, lift up a floorboard to the other, tie the speaker cables around my thing, and go, right, Dom, and then I crawled through.
Around your thing?
Something around my waist.
Okay.
Yeah, not my thing. But like that idea of, oh, go on, go have an adventure. Is important. And so don't protect the kids, make them crawl under the floorboards as an adventure, not as a punishment. Yeah, don't punish. Nice. Yeah,
good.
Do you want to see what's under the house? Yeah, there's spiders and mice and stuff under there. Here's something funny. I was talking to my sister the other day, when her less than 2 year old almost 2 year old daughter is scared, she says snake.
Yeah, wow.
She says snake.
Yeah, okay.
She can automatically associate, because she's got like the alphabet like thing, and like, you know, A is for apple, B, S is for snake. And when she's scared of something, she said, "Mummy snake."
Yeah.
What? Where? Like, but it's like her thing of like, oh no, I know that that's scary.
Oh.
Yeah, it's full on.
Wow, it's interesting.
Yeah.
He actually talks about that in the book too, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The snake is quite a really powerful metaphor.
Metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see them soon. Still panther.
Yeah.
Metal
Feline.
That's what we should have done. Should have started a rock band called Metal Four.
We can.
I've just realised it's not actually funny. It's barely a pun.
It's all right.
Metal Four.
We've got a band called Inside Zero.
What's a Metal Four?
We'll change all the lyrics to like 80s cock rock songs to like philosophical discussion topics. Metal Four.
Oh dear.
I know, sorry.
Us
off track. Get us back on track, Matt. Get us back on track.
I feel we could probably almost wrap this up. There's lots more.
There's a chapter lot. 2, we could probably just read a few little snippets. Have you got anything you want to say? So one of the things he says is, in my clinical practice, I encourage people to credit themselves and those around them for acting productively and with care, as well as for genuine concern and thoughtfulness they manifest towards others. People are so tortured by the limitations and constraint of being, capital B, that I'm amazed that they ever act properly or look beyond themselves at all. And I think, you know, we sort of touched on that earlier. It's like, my life's... That's hard.
And yeah, like, how do you ever get anything?
How do you ever get...
How do you just...
And it takes twice as long if you try and do anything, right? And then you've got to deal with other people and they add time and shit, you know, like... It's...
No, just the burden of getting through the day as a human. Yeah.
It's awesome. So that bit. Look at me with my post-it notes.
It's good.
Here we go. And this other thing which I feel really strongly about is it says here, don't underestimate the power of vision and direction. These irresistible forces able to transform what might appear to be unconquerable obstacles into traversable pathways and expanding opportunities. Strengthen the individual, start with yourself, take care of yourself, define who you are, refine your personality, choose your destination and articulate your being. As the great 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche so brilliantly noted, he whose life has a why can bear almost any how.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's very Freudian, but he falls back on the classic philosophers a lot. And like, I mean, totally openly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a... The encapsulating kind of sentiment of this chapter is the idea that you as an entity are not it. Your body belongs to you, but it's not yours to do with what you want in a negative sense. You actually need to.
Well, what you do has an impact on the world around
work
you.
Work towards being a valuable member of a society, because everything we do actually has the capacity to have consequences for everyone around us.
Yeah.
John Donne said, no man is an island.
Richard Branson has one.
He's got a version in the Atlantic as well.
Oh, wow.
No, Hank. No.
Not over it.
Wrong. I've got that wrong. Sorry.
This chapter particularly resonated with me, given some of the things I've been through, experienced, and
me too, man.
And that that idea of, I mean, I remember a time when all I was trying to do, both consciously and subconsciously, was trying to destroy my life. Like, I was trying to get it to the point where I'd done so many polarizing things that the people who were close to me couldn't possibly be around me. It was too destructive for them. They had to. It was my way of trying to. I didn't want to push people away, but I was so hurt by my circumstance that, and knowing how poorly I thought of myself at the time, and then seeing people who cared for me going through having to deal with me being like that. I felt like, if I'm thinking about it, I felt like if I could just do enough stuff to push people, to make people look at me and just go, I can't deal with that, they would leave. And then they would spare themselves of having to deal with me, and then I wouldn't have to deal with the shame of looking at them going, I can't believe I've done this stuff. So it's really interesting how it's like, actually, if you take the complete opposite approach and think of yourself as uncontemptible and someone who deserves your care, then you won't behave like that. But at the time, you know, at those times in my life, I treated myself like someone who was despicable, and I behaved like someone who was despicable, and therefore because
I don't remember being like that.
Well, that's the thing about when you are around people, you interact with them, but when you're in your own space, you're in your own space, like you're in your own mind.
Yeah, but
mind.
How did that behaviour manifest in you actively pushing people away?
Well, if you don't know that I went through what I went through, then I did a pretty good job of not letting you in.
Yeah,
and particularly pushing you away.
Yeah, okay.
And so that idea of like, we get to a gig and the first thing I do is go and give everyone a beer, because the first thing I wanted to do was be numb from booze, and everyone's like, oh, you know, Dom is always the first guy with a beer, like that makes everyone think that you're the fucking good fun guy, right? But when your motivation behind it is to be the first guy to get drunk,
I'm the first guy to get everyone a beer.
Well, you are now.
No, I know, but yes,
this is a long time ago.
You make me question everything.
Well, good, that's what this book's for.
I question nothing.
That's what this book's for.
So what's the takeaway? Make a commitment to look after yourself.
Yeah.
Make a commitment to treat your body like the temple it is, to be healthy, to gain new skills.
Yep. Well, to have a vision of what you want, to determine a vision of what you want your life to be and who you want to be, and work towards making that as close to reality as possible.
So goal setting.
Yeah, but not so much like, oh, I'm, you know, in 3 years I want to be, you know, the manager of my branch. Like, that's not personal.
What are you, a snake?
There's just so many names of things in our world that are metaphors for something else that we just don't even consider, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just realised I did something. I did a cultural appropriation when I said, isn't it, then. Tell you about it later. Yeah, I think definitely the thing that I took from it is have expectations of how you want to be, what you want to behave. Have goals for the life that you want to live. And being a victim isn't something that, self-sacrificing and being therefore being a victim or being bullied is something that's in there as well, isn't a noble cause, particularly if you are the bullier of yourself.
Yeah.
And there's another thing, I know, I think particularly through the 20th century, like through the world wars and the idea of, right, we have to ration, we're in austerity and we have to sacrifice for the good of everything. But I think there was like that went off on a tangent of punishing, not sacrificing, like self-punishment.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the nature of any austerity measure is that. It's the self-flagellation kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is a huge part of it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
For Spirit, it's pretty powerful.
It is.
Yep.
He's very big on honesty. Like, it comes back over and over.
Yeah, and it does come back over, and it's like, and he says in there as well, it is certainly references Jung again, and it's like, this is not about being nice. This is about being functional and practical, and you don't have to, and it's not about happiness either. It's about getting the job done.
Yeah.
So that you can live a good life, and a good life doesn't necessarily need to be all, you know, carefree and happy. That's not a good life.
No.
You know, you need to find your purpose and work towards things. That's when you look back and you'll go, I'm living a purposeful life.
Yeah.
And I'm happy about that. But a lot of time we spend doing anything that's purposeful is hard work. It's confronting.
That's the point.
Yeah. So
pick
I think
up the biggest load you can.
That's his.
Mm.
That's good.
All right, work.
Let's go and sing some songs.
Yeah. We're doing a gig together.
Yeah, and then separately.
Just round the corner.
Yeah.
Mm. All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, cheers.
And if you end up doing any of this reading yourself, because the great thing about reading something like this is that it's a universal topic.
Of course.
And anyone can kind of have their experience with it. It's not like you need to be a historian or a...
No, it's very relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see if anyone has anything to say.
Thanks for joining. For those of you who are new, this is Dom.
This is Matt. Together, what our powers combine.
We had that conversation last
night. Yeah, we did.
We're not going to do it now, though, are we?
See you later. See you next time. Bye-bye.
1 to 20 powers activate. Goodbye. Yoink.